We say hello to our buddy Richard Deitch of The Athletic. Richard, how you doing?
You know, when I first started doing the show back in 1927 or whatever it was, there was no video streaming. There was no Twitch. There was no law office sponsoring all this. Look at you guys forged into the 21st century as a multimedia player. So congrats on all that.
Look, we're just trying to be like these, you know, these Power Five conferences, get big TV deals and things like that. That's what we're working towards, Richard.
Yeah, I mean this with no disrespect, but I'm thinking the law office still maybe a little less zeros than the Big Ten. But these are good dreams and goals to have, no doubt.
So the SEC signs their big deal with Disney and ESPN that's going to kick in, and then the Big Ten does this gigantic deal with Fox, NBC, and CBS that's going to kick in that kicks ESPN out of having the Big Ten. What do you think the next shoe to drop is going to be when it comes to these college football television deals?
Well, I mean, the next deal either is the Big 12 or the Pac-12. Like, that, you know, I'm no genius to come up with that. Big 12 put out a statement that they were negotiating or they're open for business. ESPN quickly saying we're not negotiating. I'm sure the truth lies somewhere in the middle. But both those conferences will eventually get some kind of short to long-term deal. The real question, of course, is, like, what are those conferences? Like, will the Pac-12, like, what we see as of today, as we're talking at this early September 2022, like, is that going to be the conference in the next year or the next two? It's the same thing with the Big 12. Will we see any more expansion? Now, the Big 10 says that it's not expanding. I don't know whether to believe that or not. You know, I, as a general rule, I don't believe college administrators. I feel like that's a very good guide just in life. And then if they surprise me by telling the truth, like, it's a good day. So I'm not really sure where to go with that. But the next dominoes, quote-unquote dominoes to fall will be Big 12 and Pac-12 will sign deals. I think because ESPN, you know, depending on how you want to frame it, either opted not to deal with to do business with the Big Ten because they were not satisfied with the deal, or the Big Ten said ESPN opted, you know, or the Big Ten saying that they didn't need ESPN to do their deal. I think it's very clear that ESPN absolutely needs more college football inventory. They want to maintain that monopoly. The West Coast is very important to them, I think, in terms of windows, particularly late-night windows on the East Coast for them. So I think for sure ESPN gets in on one of those conferences in a massive way. My guess would be they'd get in on both. And I think Fox is probably a player in one of the in one of those two conferences as well. And then lastly, I would think the Pac-12, just because it's Silicon Valley, has a lot of people in the sort of the streaming world. I think they do some kind of deal with Apple or Amazon for part of their inventory as well. That would be, if I had to guess today, that's sort of my guess how it plays out.
Okay, that's the perfect segue into my next question, because Apple, Amazon, you have ESPN Plus, all the Peacock, Paramount Plus, all of these streaming entities that are connected to networks in some ways, some aren't, but that they are taking over. And we've seen the Thursday night football package for the NFL. That has gone to streaming to Amazon. It looks like Apple is going to land NFL Sunday Ticket. And I bring all this up because we did a poll question last week asking how many Titans games are you going to attend this year? And the results didn't really surprise me, but it was an interesting, you know, discussion piece, because people basically said anywhere from 1 to 5, somewhere in that range, but that's about it. And a lot of people reference that they can sit on their couch and watch all the games and, you know, see it.
There's an option for 0, and a surprising number of people signed up for 0. Like, I don't know if it was 50%, but it was a sizable number just said, I'm not going to any games.
Right. So how much are these deals and these streaming packages hurting attendance, because it's just so much easier to be able to watch whatever you want to watch from your couch?
All right, so there's, you know, that's, you know, there are college courses that could do a whole semester on all your questions there. So, but let's take, just because it's like, you know, the landscape is changing. But here's what I would say, because let's use the Titans, because you guys brought that up. That's actually an interesting result for the survey. The NFL has, one, made a decision that while they're in the streaming business now with Amazon, their primary business is still linear television, right? Like, look who they signed their deals with. They signed it with Fox, that's over the air. They signed it with CBS, that's over the air. They signed it with NBC, that's over the air. They have ESPN ABC. I guess, ESPN is not over the air, but it's traditional cable. They do have that Thursday night package now that went to Amazon. But, the reality is, and I can tell you this because I obviously talked to all these executives, it's not like there was a big, heavy bidding for Thursday night football. I mean, Fox, CBS, they've all had it at this point. NFL Network has had it. So the NFL, at least, is still sort of very much how we watch traditional television. And then to get to your point, why would Titans fans not want to go to 8 games versus, zero games? Well, price is not cheap anymore. You guys are in Nashville's a big city with big city prices. So it's not necessarily the easiest thing for, a family of three or, five buddies to go to. I think the NFL is sort of, I want to say they're not family friendly, but let's face it, NFL games, particularly tailgate situations, it's kind of a very different feel than taking some little kids to baseball games. It's just they're sort of in attendance audience is a little bit different than some other sports, and they're cool with that. And then lastly, and this is a big one, the ability to sort of get the games at the highest level of viewability. So you're talking about if you have a great smart TV in 4K, you have all the luxury of just sort of sitting in your favorite room with food coming to you, with the ability to watch Red Zone so you can see, seven different games at once. The NFL and its business partners have really made the television experience so great that you can make an argument, unless you really love to be out there and watching it live, and unless you really want to hang out with your buddies, if you want to literally watch the game itself, it's actually not close. Watching the game on television is a 20 times better experience than watching it at a stadium, just because even if you have the best seats in the house, 50-yard line or whatever, you're not seeing everything. Hard to get, you're not getting replays, generally speaking, right away, unless you're, in a suite that has a television or something like that. So I think, the NFL made a calculation in many ways, and probably a smart one, was that we're going to make the television experience as best as possible. Thus, we're going to get the billions of dollars from these media companies. And if we end up losing a little bit of attendance, the loss of that isn't going to be close to what we just made in viewership. And then lastly, I know I'm sort of rambling here. What the NFL will do for sure, and all these places are already doing it, they will try to make the stadium experience, best in class, which means the best kind of Wi-Fi. You'll, at a certain point, 10, 15, 20 years from now, you'll probably be able to bet from your seat, which has some kind of electronic device. So all that stuff's going to come. But at the moment, I don't blame fans for watching at home. It's just a more relaxing, better experience.
Yeah, you're right about that, Richard. We're talking with Richard Deitch of The Athletic, and you can catch his podcast out on Apple, the sports media podcast. Now, Richard, the U.S. Open is going on, and obviously this is Serena's last go. She beat the number two player in the world last week, and now she plays, I believe, Tomjanovic. Today.
I don't even know how you say it.
Right. Yeah.
It looks like Tom Jones. It sounds easier to say. Exactly. Tom Jones. I don't even know how to say it.
But the ratings on this, do you expect this to be the highest ratings U.S. Open has gotten in some years? And do you think it will trickle down into the men's as well?
First of all, D-Mace, I have to get up from the heart attack I just had. A national station talking U.S. Open tennis. I'm proud of you guys. This is a huge moment for me. It's not college football or the NFL. Finally, my dream. It's taken 30 years, but the South finally will embrace the U.S. Open tennis.
Hey, listen, we can talk about all sports because you are, it all.
I'm busting on you. So the viewership for the first two nights that Serena's played has been off the charts. Night one, where I think a lot of people thought, she may lose, and obviously they were going to do a ceremony. Second most watched first night in ESPN's history of doing the U.S. Open. And the first night is a relatively new phenomenon because back in the day, CBS didn't do the first night of the tournament. They did weekends. So essentially, the second most watched first night of the U.S. Open in history. That's a big, big number. The match that you just had to advance past the second round, again, did major, major business. Multiple millions of people watching. I don't think it set a record, but again, I think it was over 2.5 million or around there. Again, I can tell you, someone who covered tennis for a long time at SI, and obviously covers media. These are insane numbers for early in the U.S. Open. It doesn't exist. So as long as Serena's playing, and again, she plays tonight, the numbers will be off the charts. I don't think they would pass, let's say, a final, like, between Serena and Venus, or a final between Serena and someone, or Federer and Nadal. But you're basically going to get finals-like numbers every time Serena plays, which, again, is, I could tell you, someone who's covered tennis a long time, that's unheard of. I don't think it will filter to the men, to be honest. The reality is the two of the best draws for the U.S. Open for men are not playing, and that's Novak Djokovic, obviously, for vaccination reasons, and Roger Federer for injury reasons. Nadal's playing, and he's a draw, but Rafa Nadal versus, you know, some European that the general U.S. audience doesn't know about isn't going to do it. Where tennis is hurt on the men's side at the moment is that there's not a big U.S. men's star. Like, that person doesn't exist. And, you know, as good as, like, John Isner is against, like, the rest of the world, or as good as, like, someone like Taylor Fritz is, you know, these are top 20 players, obviously incredibly accomplished. They don't move the needle viewership-wise at all. No one's tuning in to see them yet. So if you had Federer and Nadal and Djokovic and Serena, you'd probably be looking at maybe the greatest first week ever viewership-wise of any major, because you just have the three biggest stars in the men's game in the last 15, 20 years, and obviously you have Serena, who's incredible. So to answer your question, D-Mace, no, it's not. The viewership number is like the whole night, so they get the benefit of like Serena's gigantic number when people are watching her. But like, if I could, I don't have it in front of me, but I can guarantee, like, if I broke it down, like, from Serena playing and then the match after Serena, which, you know, I think night one was Kyrgios, I bet you they lost 1.5 million viewers the second she was done. So it's not carrying over. But regardless, Serena's story, it doesn't often happen in tennis, but this is a story that transcends the sport. So you have casual fans, people who generally never watch tennis ever, they're probably sort of checking it out and following. And if she could somehow get to the second week, that's when they might be looking at 4 or 5 million people for second week matches, which, again, that's incredible. I mean, that's like a low-level Stanley Cup Finals game. I mean, this just doesn't happen in tennis. So it's a big story developing, and we'll see how she does tonight.
Yeah, and I would tell people, just flip over there, even if you're not a tennis watcher, just watch the crowd. The crowd is amazing.
Yeah,
you'll see who in the crowd, and they react to every point. Richard,
can I just tell you guys real quick? Let me just tell you real quick. I know we're short on time, but you'll appreciate this. So I covered tennis for Sports Illustrated when I was there for, I think it was 14 or 15 years of my tenure there. And a couple times, because it was a very big publication, we'd get seats in the first row. There's like 5 media seats in the first row, and they'd usually lottery it up. But SI sometimes got, let's face it, favored nation status. To see these players that close, people have no idea, like, how good the 300th best player is, let alone Serena. So if you have any dudes who, like, ever come up to you and be like, oh, I watched Serena go there, I could take a point off her. You have no idea what you're talking about. You're insane. Not only could you not take a point off her, the likelihood is you can sell her an ice cream. So relax and enjoy the trip.
Yeah.
Sorry for the film.
No, you're right. My grandfather used to take me to the matches when I was a kid, too. That's the first thing you notice is how much harder they hit the ball than it looks on TV.
Yeah.
But, Richard, real quick, I want you to hit on your podcast. I have maybe more of an interest than many on, you know, the workings of a play-by-play announcer. But your interview with Leah Hextall was really compelling. You know, I was aware of some of the stuff that was going on with her, the challenges that, you know, any female play-by-play announcer in their first year would logically get. But, wow, to hear her talk about her firsthand experience, that was really good stuff. And you know, tough when you try to put yourself in her shoes.
Yeah, no, first of all, I appreciate you listening, so thank you. And I appreciate Leah Hextall giving me just trusting me to let her tell her story. So, again, it is more than okay to criticize a female broadcaster or a male broadcaster. But a female broadcaster, if you don't like their play-by-play, their style, whatever, I would argue that someone like Leah Hextall has so much institutional things against her because there's no minor leagues for her. Most, as you know this, Willie, so many of the jobs, like in minor league baseball, minor league hockey, minor league basketball, they're male announcers. They're not women. So there's not a pipeline. So if you're Leah Hextall, you know, you got hired by ESPN, you got sort of put on the big time right away. And in many ways, you got to learn on the job. which the reality is men don't always have to do. But the real thing with this, and this is where it gets pretty gross, is she not only got social media vitriol pretty much every time she was on the air, and maybe I guess the reality of Twitter is, you know, you're on it, everybody gets it. But that included death threats, eventually, where people would track down her website and send that to her directly, including one guy who basically said that, like, I'm going to blow your brains out so I don't have to hear you call a hockey game again. Now, like, the reality is, like, you know, I'm sure law enforcement can tell you that you take all these threats seriously, and you do. And thankfully, I would imagine most of them are just anonymous jerks who are never going to follow up on it. But, like, you know, like, what if the 1 in 10 million person is the crazy person who does? And how do you just deal with that as a broadcaster when you're just trying to prepare to call a regular hockey game, as you know about, and you got to think about somebody who just declared that they want to kill you because they don't like your commentary? So I don't know how someone sort of, I shouldn't say like that, to be able to sort of go through that and then to still do the job and to still sort of like shake that off and just sort of continue on your journey, that's really impressive to me, because I think that would spook so many people. And that's what Leah Hextall talked about. It, like, again, the sexualized comments and all that stuff, it happens every day, which in itself must be just mentally exhausting. But then a couple of times it just went to a, like, literal place where people were threatening to kill her. And again, we're talking about a hockey broadcaster. But, you know, I wish I had the solution to this between anonymity and social media and misogyny and all that. But I appreciated her telling her story. And it was pretty eye-opening, man. It's, you know, as you know, play-by-play is a hard job without anything else going on. And then if that stuff's floating in your brain, that's a mess.
Well, Richard, great stuff as always. It's good to catch up with you again. We'll do it again soon, and I hope you have a good weekend.
All right. Work on that law office, man. I see a big thing.
I will.
Hopefully we'll help them to expand.
Yes. Exactly. Richard Deitch from The Athletic joining us. A lot of great stuff there. But coming up next, we'll get back into the Titans and Harold Landry. What's next for them after the ACL injury to Landry? That's all next. Chase, Willie, and D-Mace, 102.5, 106.3, The Game.